This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We're sending $1 billion a day overseas to purchase petroleum. If we were able to focus that to create biofuels, to create renewable energy, wind, solar, geothermal, and become more and more efficient, we can transform our economy to create millions of jobs right here and making ourselves prosperous in the process and ending this insidious and dangerous foolhardy dependence on importing oil.
This week on Sea Change Radio, we hear from U.S. Congressman Jerry McNerney, representing California's 11th District. In an earlier appearance on Sea Change Radio, the congressman shared his views on wind power, but in today's visit, he talks about his new book, Clean Energy Nation. In our conversation, we explore how U.S. policies on peak oil, education, poverty, and the expansive U.S. military will all play vital roles in determining this nation's future. Are you wondering what it's like to be a mathematician, engineer, and environmentalist, and work side by side among climate change-denying House representatives? Listen to my interview with Congressman McNerney to find out. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Congressman Jerry McNerney. In addition to being a congressman and engineer, he has a new book called Clean Energy Nation. Congressman, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's a real pleasure, and it's a subject I'm very excited about, so I'm looking forward to the interview.
Let's dive into what was the inspiration behind, you're a pretty busy man, what drove you to write a book?
Well, basically, the need out there is so imminent. We have a double threat of global warming and peak oil, and if we don't do anything, things are going to get bad. But if we do something, things will change in a very positive way in terms of creating jobs, in terms of cleaning up our environment, in terms of making our nation more secure. So I'm very passionate about it. I think it's something that people would be interested in if they knew more.
And what was your target demographic or audience with the book? Because it definitely, the first two-thirds or a half is a nice overview of things that have made us a fossil fuel-dependent society.
Well, you know, if you love history, then you'll like this book because there's so many discussions about how we got to where we are, the innovations that happened and the things that made us dependent on oil. If you like technology, there's a lot of discussion in technology, but it's not too technical. So I think we're really aiming for a broad audience. It's a broad subject. We haven't gone into a whole lot of depth in any one area, but we cover a whole lot of different issues, both regarding education, the technology, the economics, all the aspects, I think, that come into play on this big issue.
And you mentioned peak oil, and being a politician who is distinct from his colleagues in that you have such a technical background in the alternative energy space. Peak oil is often thought of as the territory of conspiracy theorists. But tell us what you might talk about with a fellow congressperson on the Hill when it comes to a subject like that.
Well, there really is only a finite amount of oil out there. And our use of it is increasing exponentially. We're not only increasing the number of countries that are attaining middle-class status in the United States, prosperity, so the consumption per person is increasing, but the number of people that are using petroleum, coal, and natural gas is increasing. So combined, it's an exponential increase. So even if we have twice the amount of oil that people think we have out there, we're still going to hit a wall in about 10 years. So it's important that we start making plans now.
Peak oil was not something that you were really studying when you were studying engineering and mathematics. You have a PhD in math, by the way, right?
That's right.
Where have you learned more about it? I'm just interested in what people who are making our laws know about or envision for our oil future.
Well, I started hearing about peak oil basically through articles in magazines about 10 years ago, maybe. And this Hubbard, who first sort of coined the term and understood what was going on, saw that in the United States of America, we were going to hit peak oil in the 70s. And he developed a theory to explain it, based it on the performance of the oil wells that were in existence in this country, and hit it right on the nose. If you look at the curves, boy, it makes a lot of sense. Right now, there's sufficient oil to meet the demand, but as the demand increases and the supply either stays stagnant or starts to decrease, we're going to start to see big disruptions in our economy, big disruptions in the supply of oil. National security issues will come into play. So it's a very important issue for our country, and I think everybody should be aware of it.
And how many people in Congress are aware of it?
Most people are aware that there's a phrase called peak oil. A lot of people don't believe that it's true, but I think everyone's at least aware that there is a potential for a peak oil situation to exist. A lot of people actually think that we're at peak oil right now. Several members of Congress would agree with me about that. So I think there's a sufficient awareness now whether people are concerned enough about the consequences and the immediacy of the problem is another question.
And when you sit down at the congressional cafeteria and that word peak oil comes up and you're sitting across from a colleague who thinks that we can drill our way out of any kind of problem that we have with our energy future, without getting too contentious, what is usually, is it just like talking to somebody who doesn't believe in evolution and you believe in evolution, or is this, where is the common ground?
No, there isn't a common ground. There's folks that think there's plenty of oil out there as long as we are allowed to drill. They think there's oil under the Gulf of Mexico, there's oil in Alaska, there's oil in Russia or wherever that there's major oil reserves that haven't been found yet. So it is like talking to someone from a different planet, but there's only a finite amount. I don't care how much there is out there. If we continue to increase our consumption exponentially, we're going to hit the wall. It's going to happen. So it's time to start doing something about it.
Let's talk about energy and education. The two are not discrete. They're definitely linked. And you talk about that in your book. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit more about your line of thinking on what needs to happen to try to improve our education and connect that to our energy future?
Sure, Alex. You know, I can talk from my own personal experience. It's always more relevant, and I hope listeners appreciate that. I spent my early 20s learning technology, learning physics, learning math, and then I went into industry and put that to work. I developed a modeling for wind turbines so we can understand loads, which helped us understand how to design these things. I also worked in controls, and that was very important. And I think that's a model. Folks that go through technical education, that get educated in the sciences and engineering, they're going to go out there and they're going to take up these subjects and start making improvements in the technology. For example, developing clean and deep storage batteries that can fuel a car, that can power a car for 400 miles or longer and charge quickly. Developing fusion technology would be a game changer. So there's real opportunity for folks that make it an issue to learn technology, to learn science, and then to go out there and make a difference by helping develop these new technologies. And I'll tell you what, folks that learn this technology and go out there and make a difference and help transform technology and help transform our nation, they're going to turn out to be, we're rich and powerful. So not only do you have the gratification, the self-gratification of making a difference, but you can come out pretty well in the end if you do that.
Well, we are rich and powerful, but we are also deeply divided in terms of not only our education, but also there's an enormous income gap that we haven't seen since the time of the Great Depression. Those are pretty well linked as well. What kind of solutions do you think we could take to try to accelerate the education issues that you're discussing in terms of the gap in science and math?
Well, it's important to motivate folks nowadays that are coming up in the education system to take an interest in the sciences. And that means putting money into STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. so that there's scholarships, so that we get good teachers that are excited about these subjects. There needs to be a real investment in our nation's education to make these things happen. They don't just happen on their own. What we need to do is find a way to get kids excited about these subjects so they do the hard work. Getting a degree in engineering or science is hard work, but the reward is there. And it's not just about a monetary reward. It's about understanding the beauty of science, of understanding what has been done in history. I just love math. I compare it to music. When you first hear Beethoven, you don't like it that much, but you want to hear rock music or something. But after a while, you really appreciate it. And math is the same way. You can see the beauty of it. So not only do you get some reward monetarily and being able to transform society, but you get a self-reward for participating in that. And that's what we need, is to motivate this young generation to participate and to take an interest in the subjects.
Now, some people say that politics are getting in a pretty bad fix. It's got to where you don't know what to do. If a fella don't know how to vote, he'll find out he's missed the boat. He'll be sitting behind that eight ball, too. Now, if your boss is a Democrat, you might better think about that, because a presidential election is coming up soon. But if he happens to be a Republican and you ain't, brother, then that ain't fun, because that means you're going to have to change your tune. Politics, oh, politics, you've got to know just how to vote. Kiss that baby, shine that shoe. If you know what's good for you, you got to play them politics.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Congressman Jerry McNerney. Represents, what's your district again? I'm sorry.
Well, it's the 11th Congressional District. It has part of the East Bay and part of the Central Valley. So it's a very mixed district, and I've really enjoyed being it because it's a little part of America.
It's a area that does have some mass transit solutions, but they're obviously enormous holes in the system whenever you cross the Bay Bridge and you see bumper to bumper car traffic. Where is the disconnect in terms of trying to get those funds apportioned?
Well, I think we need to look at it in terms of mutual benefit and benefit for our overall economy. If we make these investments in our infrastructure that allow people to move quickly with at low cost, with high reliability and high safety, then we'll be able to increase our commerce throughout the country. For example, we're talking about high-speed rail here in California. If we were able to put in high-speed rail, it would open up the economy in the Central Valley, which is now very depressed. So putting in these sorts of projects that allow people, not only in terms of transportation, but in terms of our overall infrastructure, will help our economy in so many ways. If you look what's happening, for example, in Kentucky right now, the bridge between Kentucky and one of the main bridges on the interstates between Kentucky and Indiana is suffering huge flaws, and they had to shut that bridge down, and it's brought commerce to a halt in that area. So I see moving people, whether it's for public transportation or efficient automobiles, electric cars, it's a real big improvement to our nation's infrastructure, to our commerce. So it creates jobs, it creates wealth, not only in the cities, but all over the country, all in the small communities that produce goods and services that are sold in the cities, and for people that commute from the rural areas to the cities to do their work, it really benefits the whole country. So I think it's definitely a good investment all up and down the country, in cities and in towns and in rural communities as well.
Just on a local level here in San Francisco, in the Bay Area, and I think this mirrors a lot of the issues that we talk about with taxation and whether it's a regressive or progressive tax. Talking about BART, the Bay Area Rapid Transit. So when you take BART from Pleasanton to San Francisco, it'll probably cost you around $8 round trip, right? Something in that area. But if three of you decide to take BART, that's $24. It pales in comparison to the $5 or $6 bridge toll that people moan about. From a local level, how do we fill those coffers so that BART doesn't have to be charging $7-$8 so that these can be a little bit more accessible, and it's not really a tax on the poor, because it becomes almost a luxury to take BART for some families.
Well, I think you've hit on a very important question. How much does the society want to invest in that sort of program that allows people to move back and forth from jobs to homes, and from homes in the rural areas to the cultural center here in San Francisco? I think it's important for us to make those investments and to help provide public transportation for people to move back and forth. We need to make that case in a way that people feel it's benefiting everyone. So it's a big challenge to get that out there, to get people ready and willing to make those kind of investments. And whoever is responsible for these decisions, they need to make a good enough case so that people support those decisions.
When you talk to your colleagues on the other end of the aisle, and the issue of poverty comes up, educational districts that have poverty levels under 10% are some of the best performing public schools in the world. But we usually just think of our public school systems as being broken systems. Do you see them being more of a function of the problem with the system, or are they more reflecting the income inequality that we are suffering from right now in this country?
There's no question that poverty is an influence on educational achievement. Now, there's some school districts or schools that you point out that are exceptional performers, and those programs need to be emulated. They need to be understood. What works in education? That's a huge philosophical question. How do we decide what works in education? Use evidence-based information on making decisions that about education. But yes, I think the belief is pretty universal that we need good schools, that we need to provide education. There's a lot of misinformation out there by some special interests that believe privatizing education, I think, is going to be the answer, when privatizing education isn't really going to solve anything more than public education, in my opinion. We need a dedicated families and communities and schools to get through this impasse. Spending more and more money is not necessarily the answer, but if you starve communities that are already in a poverty situation, you're certainly not going to help. And if you allow education to be run by corporations, I'm very wary of going down that road. Corporations really are designed about making money. They're designed about meeting the bottom line. And it's not moral. It's not immoral. It's amoral. So to put an amoral organization in charge of education, I think, is going to be considerable risk. So I want to see public education continue and be strengthened. But we also have to look at other alternative models. If they work and they produce, then we need to be open-minded to that.
We just had filmmaker Josh Tickell on the show recently. He had a film a year ago called Fuel, and his follow-up to that is a movie called Freedom, which is a pro-ethanol piece. Talk about some of your position on biofuels in the book.
Ethanol is one form of biofuel. I'm not very wild about ethanol, but I think it's an important opportunity to develop technology that can be used. Using corn for ethanol, I think, is corn is a crop that uses a lot of nitrogen and a lot of water both. So there's a trade-off in terms of using that sort of product. And also it's used as a feed substance for farm animals and so on. So I'm a little bit wary about using corn ethanol. But biofuels in general, there's a real opportunity there. We have a company here in South San Francisco that uses algae, and you can feed the algae just about any sort of waste product, and it'll produce high-quality fuels. And that's the sort of direction I see, and I hope we pointed out clearly enough in the book, is if we use things like biofuels from algae and from cellulosic ethanol, people will be out there working hard to make a living. They'll be innovating. We'll be creating wealth in this country rather than sending that money overseas. So biofuels in general, I think, is a tremendous opportunity for us if we move down that path smartly.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Congressman Jerry McNerney. His new book is Clean Energy Nation. We had a NASCAR show this spring on Sea Change Radio, and NASCAR has been a good proving ground for alternative fuels. They get to use things that wouldn't be street legal, so to speak. You talk about that in the book with, in terms of the military. Tell our listeners a little bit more about some of the thirst for oil that our military has.
Well, our military is probably, it really is the largest single consumer of petroleum in the world. So it's on their own interest to find new alternative ways, new alternative fuels, ways to become more efficient. Because if there's some sort of a conflict, look what's happening in Afghanistan. They have to ship in all their oil. They have to truck in all their oil. So if they could find a way to power their needs without depending on importing fuel through these very precarious lines, it's in their own interest to do so. I mentioned a company here in South San Francisco that produces fuel from algae. They have a contract with Pearl Harbor to supply all their liquid fuel needs. So, and they're going to be using sugarcane grown in Alaska to feed the algae. So there's real opportunities, and the military is definitely open to this because of their need and their demand. And it's not only how risky it is, but it's also the cost of this fuel for the military. I'm sure a large fraction of their budget goes into petroleum products. So if we want to reduce military expenditures, that would be a great way to go.
And the Air Force alone, you say in the book, accounts for 71% of their oil consumption. People may not think about that as we have ground troops all over the world.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Just think of some of these big transport planes, you want to be able to put tanks on those things. Tanks are enormously, they weigh an enormous amount. So these things...
These are not 727s.
No, they swallow fuel. And, you know, where I live, sometimes I can see these pilots on training on those aircraft. You know, our fighter aircraft, all these aircraft have tremendous fuel demands. And we need to be able to find a way to keep them supplied without relying on imported fuel to do it.
Do we need all these planes? And do we need this enormous military that the world has never seen before?
Well, I think every American would agree that having a having our nation secure is one of our top national priorities. If that security is being enhanced or made secure by our military, then it's important that we have them. But that's a point that I think a democratic country like ours needs to debate. It needs to be an open debate. Is that what the nation wants, is to invest a large fraction of our national budget in armed services. And if that is, then we'll continue to do it. We're sending $1 billion a day overseas to purchase petroleum. And if we were to focus our innovation, you know, America is built on innovation. It's built on hard work. If we were able to focus that to create biofuels, to create renewable energy, wind, solar, geothermal, and become more and more efficient, we can transform our economy to create millions of jobs right here, hardworking Americans, creating energy for our fellow citizens, and making ourselves prosperous in the process, and ending this insidious and dangerous, foolhardy dependence on importing oil. Which causes problems for our national security, causes problems for our environment and for our economy. So the choice is clear in my mind. We can decide to go in that direction and transform our economy and help create long-term prosperity, or we can continue on the same path and put ourselves at more and more risk for very unpleasant changes and very unpleasant future if we don't.
When you look at what we've created as a country in terms of our military versus any other industrialized nation, it just dwarfs the rest. We are really the world's police, as more than just being our own border cops. How do we get off that drain? Is there any way that we could actually begin to start dismantling this military-industrial complex?
Well, one of my concerns is how much money we spend on military contractors. I think Blackwater, it doesn't exist or has a different name now, but
Z or something, something like XE.
Those individuals are highly paid, and they're doing the same work that a lot of our troops are. Some of our ancillary services, like food and producing food at the cafeterias, is done by foreigners. I'm not sure that we're saving that much money with those programs. I think those are things that we need to look at carefully. But you're right. Over the years, the military-industrial complex has basically diversified itself throughout the states. And so if there's any one program that seems egregious, it's very hard to kill it because it has so many jobs that are being created in those districts. But the thing is, I think producing civilian goods it produces better long-term jobs and more jobs than the military production of military hardware. But, you know, the world is a dangerous place. We found that out at 9/11. We do have to have a credible military. The question in my mind is, when military expenditures become so much that it harms the rest of our economy, then where is the line drawn that it's hurting our security more than it's helping it? So that's an issue that we need, as a democratic country, we need to talk about. We need people to be aware of the cost of our military operations and of the potential risks if we allow ourselves to become weak and we allow our safeguards to come down. This is a long-term question that we need to face more squarely as a nation.
And in many ways, it mirrors the green jobs issue. When you hear debates from the plastic bag manufacturers saying, well, this would cost jobs if we had a ban on plastic bags in New York City or wherever. But at some point, we have to say, maybe these jobs are the wrong jobs. It's not a very popular decision for a politician to make, saying we need to get off of fossil fuels. And that's why I think your book is exceptional from the standpoint of, I don't think there's a lot of congresspeople or senators writing books called Clean Energy Nation or of its ilk.
Well, it is. I think the military can be part of the solution by driving the market. And I think we point that out well in our book, driving the market to develop new products that are more efficient, that are clean and renewable. And as I mentioned, it's the biggest single consumer of petroleum. So if they help drive the market, we're going to create all kinds of new products and new technologies. So I think there's a role that sector can play in terms of getting us to where we need to go.
The book is Clean Energy Nation. It's a great overview of where we have been and where we need to go in terms of freeing ourselves from the tyranny of fossil fuels, it says in the subtitle. Congressman Jerry McNerney, thanks so much for being my guest once again on Sea Change Radio.
Well, thank you, Alex. It's been a pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Cal Jader, Hank Penny, and the Rolling Stones. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Home Solar Specialists. Go to Sungevity.com to learn more. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.